In this episode, I'm going to cover a haunted place that has received the most personal experiences on my social media pages. A place that is one of the most haunted locations in Southern California. That place is Turnbull Canyon. After I posted a short video about how haunted the place was on Instagram, it went viral. In my comment section and inbox, flooded with people sharing their own stories, warnings, and don't ever go up there at night messages. Given how extensive the history of this place goes and how many crazy things have happened there, I'll be making a two-part episode for this place. This first episode will only cover the history, legends, and crimes of Turnbull Canyon, while my next episode will feature a selection of stories that I've come across regarding the place. So what is Turnbull Canyon? Turnbull Canyon is a 4-mile loop trail tucked into the Puente Hills Preserve near Whittier, California. On the surface, it appears to be an ordinary stretch of sycamore trees, sage-covered slopes, and creek-fed ravines, just roughly 20 miles east of Los Angeles. But for generations, locals, paranormal investigators, and urban legend enthusiasts have treated it as a nexus of tragedy, darkness, and inexplicable strangeness. Now let's dive into the history of what makes this place so haunted. The land before the name. Long before Europeans arrived, the land around what we now call Turnbull Canyon was part of the traditional homeland of the Gabrielino Tongva, whose presence in the Los Angeles Basin goes back thousands of years. The legend of the canyon's cursed nature accelerated under Spanish colonization. Spanish explorers had already been sailing along the California coast since 1542, when Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo, the man who in European history is credited with discovering California, had charted it for Spain. By the time the missions were being planned in the late 1700s, Spanish officials had detailed knowledge that the region was densely populated by indigenous people. California at that time had one of the highest concentrations of native people anywhere in North America. Dozens of distinct tribal groups spread across the coastline. In Cabrillo's eyes, they struck gold, because this very same system of conquest is what drove him and other conquistadors to the wealth they attained. Now, conquistadors were not provided any sort of salaries or payment for their voyages. Instead, they obtained their riches through the encomienda system, which granted Spaniards, also known as encomenderos, land, the right to demand labor and tribute from a specific indigenous community. Such tributes would include cocoa, textiles, food, and sometimes even gold and silver. And the sick part about this is that they would mask it with Christianity so that it would look holy, while it was actually an exploitative act. The crown and church claimed Spain had a God-given right to rule the Americas as long as they evangelized the people there. Palpables like inter cetera, in other terms, a formal official letter or decree issued by the Pope, essentially a legal letter with spiritual backing, literally granted Spain the land on the condition that they convert indigenous people, making them look less like savages and more like saviors. Inter cetera was one of those bulls issued by Pope Alexander VI in 1493, right after Columbus's first voyage. In plain language, it said, Spain gets the right to claim and control any newly discovered lands west of a certain imaginary line in the Atlantic, as long as those lands aren't already ruled by a Christian prince. Spain also gets the right and duty to convert the people living there to Christianity, which the bull uses as the spiritual justification for taking the land in the first place. Most Christians in power believed that indigenous religions were wrong or demonic, and that they thought they were saving people by converting them and taking them away from their practices. Indigenous ceremonies, drumming, and medicine practices were often labeled pagan or sinful, and spiritual leaders were targeted, punished, or sidelined. They believed that without baptism and faith in Christ, Indigenous people would go to hell, so conversion was framed as rescuing souls. Conversion also made people easier to control. Once you accept the colonizer's God and moral code, it's easier to fold into their laws, economy, and social order. And by the mid-1700s, Spain had already colonized Mexico and Baja California. But the vast territory of Alta California, what is now modern-day California, was essentially unclaimed by Europeans. And when the Spanish started hearing that Russian fur traders were creeping down the Pacific coast from Alaska, and that the British were also eyeing the same coastline, Spain's response was essentially, get there first or lose it. So in 1769, Spanish Governor Gaspar de Portola led what became known as the Sacred Expedition. It combined a land and sea mission with soldiers, military engineers, servants, and critically, Franciscan priests, led by Father Junipero Serra. The goal was to march up the California coast, establish military forts called presidios, and plant missions every day's travel apart. The mission served a dual purpose. It would convert native people to Christianity and also act as economic engines, using native labor, of course, to grow food and raise cattle that would sustain the Spanish military presence. It was September 8, 1771, when Mission San Gabriel Archangel was founded, the fourth in the chain of 21 California missions. They chose this location as it sat adjacent to the San Gabriel River, where abundant water meant abundant plant life, animals, and importantly, a large population of Tongva people already living nearby. Now, the Tongva's reaction to the founding was not peaceful. Spanish records note that the founding expedition was immediately confronted by a large group of armed Tongva warriors on the banks of the Santa Ana River in August 1771. And according to one Spanish account, a priest held up a painting of the Virgin Mary, and the warriors supposedly put their weapons down, though historians treat that story with healthy skepticism, due to the strong incentive to portray native resistance melting away in the face of Christian symbols, as opposed to violent measures being taken. Once the mission was established, the real violence began. However, the indigenous people simply could not match the firepower of the Spanish. Spanish soldiers had steel weapons, armor, firearms, and cavalry tactics that indigenous fighters had never encountered before. And this mismatch of firepower had made the battle even more lopsided. And through this firepower, the Tongva people were forced into the mission system through a combination of military coercion, the destruction of their food sources, and the many illnesses they would contract from the Spanish that staggered a large portion of their population, resulting in many community members becoming ill or even dying due to their lack of immunity to being exposed to new diseases, inclusive of smallpox and measles. Over time, a lot of the indigenous people faced a grim calculation. If they keep fighting, they lose more people. But if they cooperate, they can maybe protect at least some of the community's lives, land, or tradition, at least in hidden ways. And as more indigenous people gave in, the Spanish justified their acts by ensuring that those who convert will go to heaven as long as they devote their lives to the regime and completely abandon something that they believed in their entire lives, promising these people food, clothing, a better way of living, alongside protection and care in order to lure them in, although many encomenderos would ignore this obligation, forcing converted indigenous people into hard labor, flogging, and disease, while also expecting tribute. Indigenous people were forced to work long hours in the fields, mines, and workshops under threats of violence, with unrealistic quotas and brutal punishments. The Tongva were forced to build the missions with their own hands, farm the fields, tend the cattle, make the bricks, tan the hides, and feed the Spanish soldiers stationed at the presidios. And at least 90,000 indigenous people across California were kept in mission compounds, described by historians as de facto slavery. And once baptized, the Tongva were legally prohibited from leaving the mission, and those who escaped were hunted down by Spanish soldiers and forcibly returned. Punishments for disobedience included flogging, shackling, and imprisonment. The Tongva shaman, Toy Perina, who grew up outside the mission walls, watched more and more of her people being drawn into this cycle. And through her frustration, alongside the disappearing supply of food outside the mission, she gathered an army of Tongva men and planned to sneak into Mission San Gabriel at night on October 25th, 1785. They would go after the Spanish soldiers and priests and drive the Spanish out. A Spanish corporal had overheard talk of the attack, so when Toy Perina and roughly two dozen or more warriors scaled the mission walls, soldiers were already waiting for the ambush. Many escaped, but 21 people were captured, including Toy Perina and Nicholas Jose, a man who lived inside the mission who coordinated the attack with Toy Perina. Most of the captured men were publicly flogged, 15 to 25 lashes, as a warning to the rest of the native community. Toy Perina, considered too influential to simply whip and release, was imprisoned for well over a year. And during that time, her child was taken from her. To be freed, she had to accept baptism, take a Christian name, and live as a neophyte at missions far away. First at Mission San Carlos Borromeo in Carmel. Later, at Mission San Juan Bautista. She eventually would marry a Spanish soldier at Carmel, had several children, and would pass away in 1799 at about 39 years old. Whether she inwardly embraced Christianity or went along as a survival move is debated. Some historians think that she had no real choice. Exile and conversion were the only way to stay alive and out of Spanish prison, and she couldn't safely return to her home community after a failed revolt. Others argue that her actions later in life might show that she had some degree of adaptation to or acceptance of her new world, but even then, that doesn't erase her role as a resistance leader. Now back to how this all connects to Turnbull Canyon. Now there is no solid historical proof of what the Tongva thought of the area we now call Turnbull Canyon, but in modern literatures, the original inhabitants of the land called the canyon Hotukna, and this meant the place of death and darkness. Tongva shamans reportedly used the canyon as a site to cast out tribal demons and other malevolent spirits, and the tribe as a whole would not enter the canyon for everyday purposes. Now, I couldn't find much historically to confirm this actual belief, but I did see that there could be some sort of false association with another place, an actual real Tongva place called Hotukna, a large Tongva village on the Santa Ana River, and what is now Yorba Linda. Unconfirmed accounts claim that the Tongva who refused to convert would be marched into the canyon as a test of Christian faith. The Spanish reasoning that God's protection would shield those who truly converted. Some accounts claim that those who refused conversion were executed on the spot, and that those who did convert believed that they were cursed to never leave the confines of the dark place. It's very unclear whether the Spanish literally marched Tongva people through this exact canyon as a test of faith, but what is clear is that this landscape sits on Tongva land and carries the scars of mission-era violence and resistance, and many locals believe that the canyon is haunted by the restless spirits of those indigenous people who suffered and died during that time, manifesting as shadows, disembodied drums, and ghost children, which has been commonly reported in many of the stories I have come across regarding this location.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. Forhers.com/women. Weight Loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
William Workman and the Curse of Bad Fortune. Before we get into this part, it's important to note that in 1821, Mexico won its War of Independence from Spain and took control of Alta California, including all the missions and mission lands. To briefly state why such an independence was declared, well, there was a difference between Spaniards that were actually from Spain and Spaniards born in Mexico. Despite having money and education, Spaniards born in Mexico were blocked from top government and church positions. Additionally, Spain extracted wealth, including silver, taxes, and trade controls from Mexico, while limiting local industry and trade. People living in Mexico essentially believed that Spain was benefiting way too much from the work they did. Now, I won't go into all the details because that's a story for a different podcast, but essentially, Mexico officially broke away from Spain in 1821. During the Secularization Act of 1833, Mexican politicians saw the missions as too powerful, too loyal to Spain, and sitting on way too much land. They decided that the land should be put under Mexican civil authorities, effectively taking legal ownership away from the Franciscan order. On paper, half of these mission lands and goods were supposed to go to indigenous people, the former neophytes. In practice, however, very little land ever reached indigenous families. Officials decided that native people weren't capable of managing it properly and steered most grants to Mexican elites, officers, and well-connected settlers instead. The freed-up land would then be regranted as ranchos. Big private estates like Rancho La Puente to people the government wanted to reward or anchor in the region. In 1845, the Spanish governor of Alta California deeded a massive 49,000-acre spread to two settlers, John Rowland and William Workman, who had emigrated from Taos, New Mexico, a place where they ran a distillery together. The land was part of the former Mission San Gabriel estate. Both Rowland and Workman came from Taos with letters of recommendation from powerful locals claiming that there were trustworthy settlers that were useful and were willing to become Mexican citizens, offered to pay $1,000 in gold, and they were ready to hire local native workers in order to turn the land into a productive rancho. The land also included the present site of Turnbull Canyon. Now, from the start, Workman's tenure was adversarial. There was real tension and resistance from the Gabrielino natives, who had previously been forced to work the land, especially since they also didn't get the land. And this tension would result in the theft of livestock, occasional raids, and ongoing hostility. And some modern write-ups claim that, given the constant raids on his property, workmen had responded by building a tunnel and underground living space under his adobe home so that the family could hide. And the Gabrielino later worked for workmen. They reportedly encountered ghosts and witches in the underground tunnel, which terminated at a family burial ground called El Campo Santo, known as one of the oldest private family burial grounds in LA County. After the Mexican-American War occurred in 1846 through 1848, California became part of the United States, independent from Mexico. And in order to jump into the new U.S. economy, Workman and his son-in-law co-founded Hellman, Temple & Company with banker Isaias Hellman in 1868, before forming their very own branch, Temple & Workman Bank, in 1871. Their bank became popular, but was badly run. Very loose lending, poor record keeping, too much money tied up in speculative projects, and not enough cash on hand. And when a major financial panic hit in 1875, tied to a silver mining bubble bursting in Nevada, a wave of fear reaches Los Angeles. People rush to pull their money out. Temple and Workman, already overextended, can't even cover their withdrawals. They borrow over $340,000 from investor Lucky Baldwin on brutal terms. But the confidence is gone, and within weeks, depositors drain the bank anyway. On January 13, 1876, Temple and Workman Bank had permanently closed, the first big bank failure in LA history. Workman loses most of his land and wealth, and a few months later, passes away by ending his own life at his adobe. The man behind the name, Robert Turnbull. The canyon's namesake carries its own dark history. Robert Turnbull was a Scottish immigrant who arrived in the San Gabriel Valley in the 1870s. He made a modest fortune in real estate, and Turnbull was already active in small real estate deals in Los Angeles. The man would essentially buy acres of land, land that was incredibly cheap for the time, eventually acquiring land in the canyon with a stream running through it, a geographical feature that was ideal for raising sheep. During this time, he became a well-known but disreputable figure locally. A drunk, a loudmouth, according to contemporary accounts. A group of Quakers who had established a settlement in the area wanted to purchase Turnbull's land for years, but Turnbull would refuse because to him, selling didn't make any financial sense since he was already making money on the land due to the valuable working sheep operation that he had going, meaning he was making a ton of money selling wool. If he was going to sell that land, it was going to have to be for a large number. The Quaker founders of Whittier, through the Pickering Land and Water Company, wanted the canyon for the same reason: water and gravel. They needed a reservoir site and construction material for their new town, and they knew that buying that canyon would give them a crucial resource. On June 7, 1887, they finally came back with an offer of $30,000, worth just $1 million today, nearly as much as they paid for the entire town site of Whittier. Can you believe that? Now that was far higher than anything Turnbull had ever been offered for a single property before, and high enough that he finally said yes. And shortly after the transaction, in 1888, Robert Turnbull's luck had ran out completely. On Wednesday, January 18, 1888, Turnbull went out drinking at St. Charles Hotel, deemed his favorite tavern, and the man got so drunk that he fell off his horse and was arrested for public intoxication. Turnbull was released the next morning in terrible condition. His housekeeper, Mary Kate, noted that his face and body were covered in severe bruises, suggesting that he had been brutally beaten, something he had brushed off. A day or two later, a group of kids found his body near the Los Angeles River. His skull had an older fracture with blood clots, several days old. The coroner decided that he died from a hemorrhage caused by that earlier blow to the head and ruled it death by force or violence at the hands of a person or persons unknown. Legally, a murder, but with no suspect named. There could have been many motives as to why he may have been beaten or targeted. The man had just made a huge amount of money from the land sale, which makes robbery, resentment, or a bad debt as potential motives, especially for a loud, frequently drunk person who talked too much. Fortunately for him, the crime was never solved. In an act of honor, or perhaps irony, the Quakers named the canyon after the slain drunkard. The Electrodome. One of the canyon's more obscure but historically grounded legends involves the Electrodome, a weather control device constructed in the early 1930s. Inventor William Haight believed that he could generate negative electrical currents into the atmosphere to create rain, displace fog, and prevent frost on crops. Haight was very vocal in public about his weather control ideas in general. An old newspaper piece on his Electrodome rainmaking apparatus quotes him explaining how his device projected negative electrical currents upward to disturb the balance between the negatively charged ground and the positively charged air to trigger rain. In his own words, the tower had to be high enough to escape ground magnetism so that it could influence the upper layer of air. That same coverage says that he claimed excellent results from previous experiments, meaning that he actively promoted his successes to reporters and city officials rather than keeping things secret. With financial backing from a citrus farmer named John Dodrell, Haight built a massive tower on an existing oil derrick inside Turnbull Canyon. The Electrodome reached 125 feet high. The final test of the device reportedly took place on New Year's Eve 1932, at the stroke of midnight. But the results of the final test are largely unknown. There is no media coverage of the experiment's outcome, and given how enthusiastic Haight was about his weather control ideas, it's very surprising that there was never anything said about the thing after the final test. Or maybe it just didn't work. Maybe he didn't want to admit that something that he was working on for so long was all for nothing. Maybe there were other reasons, but what was left behind was a rusted, eerie tower in the canyon, one that became intertwined with later legends about an abandoned asylum on site and its electroshock equipment, which I'll get into pretty soon. The Russian government was also reportedly interested in Haight's technology, and more advanced versions of the concept are said to have been developed by multiple governments. And as for Haight, the last trace they could find of him is from 1934. Just one night he was driving home, he got a flat tire, pulled over, and started changing it on the side of the road. And while he was out of the car, a drunk driver had lost control, smashed into his vehicle, and ended his life instantly. The Asylum in Hell's Gate. Perhaps no legend is more enduring or more debated than the supposed insane asylum said to have operated in the canyon. The story holds that a mental institution flourished somewhere in the canyon floor during the 1930s, notorious for its cruel and experimental treatment of patients. According to the legend, the facility burnt to the ground in the early 1940s due to a mysterious fire, ending the lives of many people that were inside the building, leaving behind concrete foundations, rusted pipes, and a stone chimney. A companion story emerged from those ruins. Sometime around 1962, a group of teenagers partying in the asylum's old remains allegedly found a long-dormant electroshock device. One daring boy applied the electrode probes to his own head as a joke. Little did he know, he would mistakenly send several thousand volts through him, ending his life instantly. The chilling element of the story is that the electricity had been supposedly been shut off for decades before the incident, making the power surge inexplicable and suggesting supernatural interference. Many believe that this orphanage is what used to lie behind what locals have now called the Gates of Hell, a set of iron gates off Descending Drive in Hacienda Heights, near the intersection with Skyline Drive. The gates are marked with private property signs and warning notices about a dog. Explorers who have gone beyond the gate have generally found concrete slab ruins, overgrown vegetation, and ultimately, someone's private property, leading to the theory that the Gates of Hell is simply the fortified back entrance to a private residence whose owner has grown tired of trespassers. It is unknown whether this was truly the location of the supposed asylum. There is also no historical record of a mental asylum in Turnbull Canyon confirmed. However, the ruins behind the gate are real, and their origin has never been definitively established. The Orphanage Cult. Among the most disturbing legends is the one tied to the Great Depression. During the 1930s, rumors circulated that Turnbull Canyon was the site of a secretive cult that specifically targeted children. And according to the legend, members of this cult would adopt small children from overcrowded, overwhelmed orphanages and bring them into the canyon. There, the children were allegedly kept in captivity inside a barn, used in rituals, and some were said to have been sacrificed and sold. As adoptions dried up, the cult allegedly turned to runaways and then to outright kidnapping, before it seemingly faded from existence. The baby selling and child ritual component of this legend is difficult to verify. No archival newspaper reports, law enforcement records, or court proceedings have been cited to confirm it. Witnesses at the time and in subsequent decades have reported seeing figures in black hooded robes on the canyon's hillsides at night. A 1974 eyewitness account described arriving at a gated fenced area and seeing 8 to 10 people in black robes standing in a circle around a small fire before speeding away. Whether these were a satanic cult, a theatrical performance, or something more mundane has never been resolved. The crash of Flight 416. Unlike many of Turnbull Canyon's legends, the plane crash is a documented historical fact. On April 18, 1952, a Curtiss C-46F commando operated by Robin Airlines flying flight RBN-416W from New York City to Hollywood Burbank Airport crashed into the Puente Hills approximately 2 miles east of Whittier at 3:34 a.m. All 29 occupants, including 26 passengers and 3 crew members, were killed. A local rancher, Hayden Jones, only spotted the crash when morning fog began to lift, and he saw black smoke rising from behind the hills when checking on his cattle. Climbing for a better view, he found the burning debris and alerted authorities. The Civil Aeronautics Board, CAB, investigated and concluded that the probable cause was a pilot error. The captain descended below the minimum safe altitude and poor visibility to try to get under the fog, leaving the aircraft about 10 feet too low to clear the ridgeline. The investigation also revealed a cascade of violations. Robin Airlines had accumulated more than 40 regulatory violations, including overweight aircraft, excessive crew flight hours, and failure to use approved safety equipment. And the wreckage has never been fully removed from the canyon hillside. Modern investigators and hikers who have gone to the crash coordinates describe small, twisted metal fragments and other debris still embedded on the steep slope where Flight 416 hit. This crash has been associated with the narrative that it happened on cursed land, and has also added to the ghostly activity reported in the region, as there have been reports of phantom engine noises, echoes of explosions, or smoke that appears randomly where the wreck once burned. The Verified Crimes. At around 5:22 a.m. on October 12, 2002, deputies were called after motorists in Hacienda Heights had found a badly injured body on Hacienda Boulevard, north of Colima Road, and upon arrival, they thought the woman was a pedestrian that had been struck by a car, possibly a hit and run. The woman was identified as 17-year-old Gloria Gaxiola, who was a local from Baldwin Park. When investigators examined the scene, they realized her life had ended elsewhere, not where she was found, and that she bore injuries from being dragged for an estimated 4 miles. A local Turnbull write-up explains that she had been shot on or near Turnbull Canyon Road. Her foot became caught in a seatbelt or strap when they tried to drive away, and her body was unintentionally pulled behind the car all the way down into Hacienda Heights, where her body finally became loose. And for several years, the crime was unsolved. And then, in 2008, authorities announced that 3 men, Abraham Ruben Acuna, Matthew Andrew Garcia, and Victor Manuel Mange, had been arrested and charged. And according to summarized court reports, the men were friends with Gloria and believed that she might snitch on them for a robbery that they committed that she was aware of. And in order to keep her silenced, the trio lured her out to Turnbull Canyon, an isolated place where they thought they would get away with the crime. It's unknown whether dragging her body was truly unintentional, but it was thought that by doing so, it could potentially make her unrecognizable, destroy forensic evidence such as clothing, fingerprints, or any traces that could lead back to them, and leave her in a different jurisdiction so that the connection to the canyon and to them would be harder to see. But unbeknownst to them, her body being dragged into the area that it was left in resulted in mass media coverage due to the extreme injuries that she suffered. And as a result of their crime, all 3 men were sentenced to a minimum of 55 years to life in prison. And the next case happened in March 2011. In March 2011, a jogger found the body of a woman down an embankment near Turnbull Canyon Road and Skyline Drive in Hacienda Heights, in an area of steep slopes and dense foliage that made the scene difficult to process at night and as rain approached. Coroner's records initially listed her as Jane Doe number 11, later identifying her as 41-year-old Claudia Tecquelson. She had passed away from a gunshot wound to the head. And a local feature on Turnbull Canyon notes that when police recovered her, she was lying about 10 feet below the roadway in a brush and was reportedly missing her left arm, a detail that led at least one nearby resident to speculate without official confirmation that her life had been ended by the devil worshippers who keep certain parts. Sheriff's detectives treated the case as a homicide, and a year later, coverage reported that Claudia's boyfriend, a man identified in court records as Francisco Nila Rojas, was responsible for the crime. According to court coverage, records show that he had recently purchased a gun on February 12, 2011. Investigators also discovered that he had stolen money from Claudia's bank account both before and after her passing. and only 5 days after the crime, he fled the country, leaving the United States for Mexico, which made him a wanted fugitive. And for several years, he remained out of reach. But in October 2015, authorities located him in Mexico, and he was returned to the U.S. to stand trial in Los Angeles County. At trial, prosecutors laid out the timeline. And on February 24, 2017, a jury took less than a day to find Rojas guilty of first-degree murder for killing Claudia and leaving her in the canyon. Crime Desk reporting notes that he faced a maximum sentence of 50 years to life in state prison, a punishment reflecting both the premeditation, which was buying the gun, and his attempt to run after the homicide. Turnbull Canyon is just one of those places where the line between legend and reality never quite holds. Out here, you have centuries of Tongva trauma, a dead drunk whose name is on the land, a midnight rain machine, a rail plane torn open on the hillside, and modern murders carried out by very human monsters, all crammed into one narrow strip of road. If today's episode left you looking over your shoulder the next time you drive Turnbull at night, make sure you don't miss what's coming next, because the next episode of the Scarecast, I'm stepping away from the history books and case files and diving headfirst into the first-hand accounts of people who ventured into this very canyon. So subscribe, turn on notifications, and get ready, because next time, it's your stories taking us back into the dark.